Hello everyone and welcome to our The Week That Was in Europe podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher. I'm the head of European Macro Research at Natixis, and with me is Julius Klaus Adam, Professor of Economics at the University of Mannheim.
Hello also from my side. Today we would like to discuss about the prospects for a European geopolitical strategy. Geopolitical thinking is something that until very recently has been conspicuously absent in Brussels, as the EU mainly understood itself as a global economic power that was operating in a rules-based international system that is protected by the United States. Now, with the US dramatically rethinking the parameters of international interaction and new actors starting to deliberately exploit the weaknesses of the former rules-based order, the EU is somehow left without a real framework under which it operates. And the question we'd like to discuss today are, what would a geopolitical strategy for the EU consist of, and what could be its guiding principles? We want to discuss these issues with Guntram Wolf from the German Council on Foreign Relations. Guntram joined the Council as its CEO in August of 2022, and prior to that, he was for many years director of Bruegel, a Brussels-based think tank dealing with predominantly economic policy issues in Europe. So Guntram combines economic expertise with political and geopolitical thinking. Welcome to the podcast, Guntram. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Adam and Dirk. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so not too long ago, political analysts were seeing something like the end of history taking the form of a world in which all major countries would somehow gravitate towards the superior model of Western liberal democracy. It would just be a matter of time, so the dominant thinking not too long ago, for other countries to adopt these models and these forms of government. And clearly, in such a world where the West is surrounded by friends, there's no real need for any geopolitical strategy. Yet we find ourselves now in a world with a newly imperialistic Russia, an autocratic or perhaps even dictatorial China, and an India that is moving away from open democracy more towards autocratic structures too. And the recent attack on Israel is just the latest horrific reminder how far away we are from the end of history, so to speak. So how have we dreamt of this end of in history? Have we been too naive for too long with respect to the way the world operates, particularly in Western Europe? And what explains that naivety?
Well, Francis Fukuyama gave this end of history at the end of the Cold War. The Soviet Union had collapsed, and the Western world was really at the peak of its power. The share of global GDP that the G7, the European Union, the EU, and in particular the US and its allies had was at its peak. And it was a moment where militarily the Russian challenge, the Soviet challenge, seemed much, much weaker, much less relevant than it was during the Cold War. And China in particular wasn't yet either an economic superpower nor a military superpower. So it was this moment where, and the economy was going great. And as you remember, in among economists, we then talked at some stage about the Great Moderation, which came a bit later. It came, I guess, in the 2000s, when inflation rates were structurally quite low, and global supply was increasing. China was brought into the world economy, flooded the world economy with cheap products, and it was a period during which it all seemed fine. No trade-offs, macro trade-offs, but also no military worries. And so that was the Great Moderation period. And I think what this period underestimated is, of course, the rise of China, the very important rise of China, both economically as well as militarily. And it underestimated Vladimir Putin's determination to turn Russia into, I would say, almost a semi-mafia state where the entire resources of Russia are being used by the regime for pursuing geostrategic objectives.
Well, let's start with some basics here then. What are the main components of the geopolitical strategy that the European Union needs to formulate?
Well, I mean, we haven't, as the European Union, we haven't really had a geopolitical strategy. And I think it starts from a very simple observation, which is the EU treaties. I mean, the EU treaties, so the basis of the European Union, integrate economic policy making. We have a very integrated single market policy. We have integrated competition policy, state aid policy. We have an integrated trade policy. And of course, we also have an integrated monetary policy. We don't have an integrated fiscal policy, but we are struggling to think about that. But the one thing we do not really have is a coherent integrated foreign and security policy. So that foreign and security policy remains largely in the realm of national policy making. So we're talking of national security and not EU security, it's national security. And whenever there is a foreign policy decision that is taken by the EU, it needs to be taken essentially by unanimity. And that is not always easy given how heterogeneous our union is. I mean, we have been able to show that on some matters we can sustain that unity. And I think here of, for example, the sanctions against Russia, where we have had several packages of sanctions. But it is really institutionally, the EU is basically not prepared for a world in which security considerations, foreign policy considerations, and economic considerations are thought together. And that really puts the EU apart from all the other powers. I mean, the United States has a president who presides over the economic strategy, but also over the security strategy. And these interlinkages are extremely difficult from an institutional point of view. On top of it, if I can say so, the EU really had this very strong belief, also hardwired in the treaties, that it needs to be a fully open economy with full capital account openness and trade openness, and where sort of security considerations in that regard aren't really in the treaties. I mean, it's really the treaties really talk about, I mean, basically being in a rules-based international order. And so that's why I think the EU has found it institutionally hard to respond. But of course, in practical terms, the EU has responded and there have been a number of steps. And well, I can talk about sort of the key steps that I see and the key steps that I think are necessary.
Yeah, so the EU perhaps, and that was for a long time also the internal narrative, saw itself as a force of peace. And there was this, I mean, there could of course be a debate as to what this is, whether this is historically really true, but it saw itself as a force of peace, and that's how it sort of designed itself. And now we are waking up to a very different world. And so one component of a foreign security or national foreign security or foreign policy that is sort of more geopolitical in terms of its thinking is, of course, a military component that is underpinning that strategy. So what role does military power play really in being able to formulate and follow through with a geopolitical strategy? What role would you assign to it?
Well, I mean, I would say the European Union relies in its defense largely on NATO. And in NATO, the United States is the dominant player. that starts from nuclear deterrence, but it goes much deeper into strategic thinking, the capacity to mobilize military force, the capacity to have appropriate intelligence on threats. I mean, all of that has been also outsourced and have been outsourced. And Germany in particular had been extremely reliant after the end of the Cold War on the United States. I mean, the peace dividend can be computed as the gap between spending on German defense and a hypothetical spending of 2%, which is the NATO goal, 2% of GDP. And if you compute that over the last 30 years, according to a study by the Institute für die Wirtschaft in Cologne, you come up with numbers, three-digit billion numbers, so several hundred. I mean, it depends on how you exactly estimate it, but I think the range is between 400 and 700 billion of underspending on domestic defense. And that is German defense, right? And so the first thing is really, how do you bring these national defense units together and ensure that they operate together across the European Union, which at the moment can only be done by NATO. It's not being, there's no EU institutions. Without that military power, that coming to your question, of course, you are entirely dependent on those that provide the military umbrella. And I think in the current situation, we see how much both the European institutions, but also the German government are looking to Washington for major decisions. That starts from decisions, what kind of weapons to deliver to Ukraine. But it also goes to, of course, more sanction questions, export restrictions. I mean, the Netherlands, for example, has restricted the export of ASML lithography machines that are needed to print the print computer chips. And, you know, that decision was basically driven by the United States. And clearly, the Commission President and Ursula von der Leyen are looking a lot to Washington when they think about even hardcore economic questions such as trade policy questions. And so I think it's a direct result of our military dependence.
Is the underspending or the motive behind it more an economic one, kind of free riding, which we didn't have to spend the money, that's good? Or is it more a pacifist reflex that has been nurtured for a long time, that in the end we should all get along together and the right attitude, negotiations, all that will the trick? There's no real need for a stick to have in order to facilitate that approach. Which of the two is it, or is it a combination of both?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably both. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, before the end of the Cold War, so in the 80s, Germany actually spent quite a bit on military, and it had, you know, a significant standing army. And the feeling after the breakdown and the fall of the Soviet Union was, well, Germany, we are surrounded by friends, right? I mean, we brought in the Eastern and Central European countries into the European Union. They are all friends now. And it's that feeling that I think drove the reluctance to invest. And yes, you, of course, it was an outsourcing and a free riding on the broader security provided by the US, but it was driven by feeling a vast feeling of security, and perhaps even that feeling of the end of history that was quite dominant in the 90s and in the early 2000s.
So what do you see as the key military capacities that you need to develop? In which area is it? So just a common army, or do specific things Europe would need to do in order to be able to kind of protect itself and not being so reliant on the US as we are right now?
Well, look, I'm not a deep sort of military expert, as you introduced me. I'm a sort of really traditional economist, and have done and worked most of my life on economic questions. But I guess what I see is as a worrying prospect is a scenario where a US president would be less committed to European security. And I mean, let's just say president called Donald Trump. We saw that under Donald Trump presidency one, the commitment to NATO was already significantly weakened. I think the risk is real that that could be worse in a presidency Trump too. And in that scenario, the key question to my mind is really who coordinates and who brings together the European military powers. I mean, at the moment, it is the US National Security Advisor who calls around and basically tells people what kind of weapons to deliver and coordinates the strategy at the political level. And the US holds, of course, also, and there I'm a little bit less firm, holds some strategic military assets at the NATO level, which no other European country has, or only to a very limited extent. And the one that is, I guess, the most, the biggest and the most controversial is the nuclear deterrence, right? I mean, that is the US plus, of course, France and the UK. And if the US commitment was to be somehow in doubt, there is ultimately the question who would provide the nuclear deterrence, especially for countries to the east of, certainly to the east of France, but even more so to the east of Germany. So, right. So basically the Baltics.
Yeah, right. It's not clear whether France would actually use its nuclear force in order to protect these countries. Is that what people call in question, I suppose. And now, so would you think it's an important step for the EU to sort of develop its own nuclear deterrence in order to be independent of the United States or individual countries within the European Union? So to fend off, say, other nuclear powers, in particular Russia, of course?
Well, you're asking a very, very big question, Adam. You know, I haven't written on that question. I do think it's a question that needs to be asked. But I do not know what is the right answer, because there are a multitude of implications, of course, if one was to do this. I mean, even thinking of it, and, you know, we all learned game theory, right? I mean, even thinking in terms of game theory, there's one thing having a world in which you have three major nuclear powers. So let's say the US, Russia and China, plus some smaller nuclear powers, and a world in which there would be an additional one, namely the European Union. I mean, that changes strategic balances. And I think it's really a worthwhile research project to look into this and think about this also from a game theory perspective. But, you know, I haven't really done this, but I do think it's a question that needs to be asked.
So when it comes to geopolitical strategy, there are often very difficult trade-offs involved. So economic interests, for instance, more often than not, would push towards ignoring those geopolitical implications. This, for example, the case when it comes to selling high-tech equipment abroad that is of dual use, i.e. that can be used for commercial or military purposes, and selling such equipment can be quite profitable in economic terms, but can easily backfire in terms of its geopolitical implications. And individual economic actors tend not to internalize these geopolitical consequences. So what can and should be done here to better align private interests with public interests?
Well, I mean, I wrote a paper and a newspaper article, which I presented to EU finance ministers only a few weeks ago, in which I asked these questions about geoeconomic, essentially the economic security strategy that the European Union should pursue. And I think your point is absolutely right. I mean, it is not private firms that can internalize security questions and dual use questions of their technology. I mean, private firms have an objective to make money out of their sales. Of course, China, Russia to a lesser extent, and many other countries are interesting markets where you want to sell your products. And that's what firms should be doing, and that's what they are made for. So if there is a concern about the fact that a certain technology can be used both for civilian applications as well as military applications, it is for governments to essentially tell those firms that there is a limit here and they shouldn't be exporting those products. I mean, that is what we've seen at the start of the war of Russia against Ukraine. I mean, the major war after February 24, there have been extensive lists of dual use goods that actually matter for military production. And with a colleague, I looked at some of those. And I mean, these are trivial things. I mean, so for example, we digged out an example where the restriction of an injection pump for a diesel engine, so it's a Bosch injection pump, was that was limited. And it actually did affect the production of a certain type of military truck that is also based for some armed vehicles in Russia. And it took the Russians many, many months to actually find an alternative. And so in that sense, it was a direct military gain to have restricted that, you know, very simple product of an injection pump. The big and sort of important question is, of course, as regards China, where the US actively tries to limit basically high-tech computing power, and in particular chips, and the production of chips, with a clear view that these are very, very important for artificial intelligence applications and high-end intelligence applications, which are needed for missile guidance and other military products. And so there's this area where there's direct military applications where you really want to sort of limit, and where I think the EU needs to have a view and needs to at the moment cooperate with the United States, and it is doing so. I guess the main point I would make there is, at some stage, the European Union needs to develop its own strategy. And that means, first and foremost, you have to define what is a security risk and what is a dual-use military good. You cannot just rely there on the United States, because, as always in economics, there are trade-offs. I mean, and you have to weigh these trade-offs, and we might weigh them differently than the United States. And the problem is, institutionally, we are not prepared for that. We have the ASML decision to limit export. The Dutch government decision to limit the export of ASML lithography machines then had the consequence that, Zeiss Optik, that delivers the optics for these lithography machines, was also limited. And now we have even a debate, I can tell you, even at in the German government, whether now we need to think about restrictions to German workers that have worked in the Zeiss Optik factories and know how to do these things, to not be employed by China, right? So you know, we have a national decision that has massive implications for the entire European, the entire integrated market. And when it comes to retaliation, of course, if China was to retaliate, the first thing that will happen is that the Dutch will call the trade commissioner. And so I guess my point here is, we need a consistency in approach. And if you are in an integrated single market, you have at some stage in this more geopolitical world also come to a more integrated security assessment.
Right. And we are, as you alluded to earlier on, in a situation where we have a rather fractured architecture of security, because it resides at the national level. But it would perhaps be desirable to move it up to the EU level, to internalize a lot of the side effects vis-a-vis outside EU actors. Now, the reason we have it located at the national level is, of course, that there are quite different views and interests that are present in different countries or different parts of the Union. And the question is, will we be effective in overcoming, you know, these fractured interests and sort of be able to arrive at what is perhaps a more coherent overall strategy? So how do you assess the chances there of sort of getting something going, perhaps in this area of export control and so on, which are more of an economic nature? This could be easier relative to areas where, you know, we would have to make a larger leap, like military or sort of other areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Adam, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's disagreement on many of these issues, but let me give you my optimistic pitch. We've always been sort of able to find compromises and move together when the threat is real, right? I mean, we know this. You and I, we are veterans of the Eurozone crisis. We know that views were very divided on what to do with countries like Greece. But, you know, when we looked into the abyss, I mean, eventually, you know, people were coming together and finding compromises. And I think given how big the geopolitical challenges are, we will have no choice but to work on these issues and find common agreements. And I mean, just to give you one little example, I mean, when Latvia or Lithuania, I forgot now, opened this Taiwan office and put the shield out Taiwan, I mean, they all of a sudden became subject to major economic coercion from China. Now, that economic coercion from China didn't only affect Lithuania, it affected the entire EU. I mean, China was basically forcing these companies not to import from Germany anymore. And so I think at that stage, everybody sort of realized, oh, yes, I mean, we have actually a problem and we need to work together. We cannot let that happen. And the Commission then, I think, rightly coordinated a strong response on economic coercion and is now putting forward legislation. And I think that legislation is actually in the final stages, if I remember correctly, on anti-coercion measures, right? Where if a single country is subject to coercion, the entire EU can react.
Does it also mean that Lithuania should have asked the others first before opening this up? I mean, when you're kind of in it together, then you need to coordinate that part as well, right?
Well, I guess my answer to that would be yes. I mean, the logical step is yes. It should ultimately, these things should be decided together.
So we touched a couple of times on China and its relationship with the EU. Obviously, that's going to be quite significant for the economy, how things will develop here. So how should Europe handle its relationship with China? Is appeasement, confrontation, the mix? What's the right balance here? And are there areas where we need to decouple and other areas where it should remain fully engaged? There's no downside risk of remaining engaged.
Well, I mean, I do think we need to talk to China. I think it's important to continue being in a strong conversation with China. China is an important country and its importance will grow. I also do think that there are some areas where we are highly dependent on China, and there we need to use proper economic thinking of how to reduce that economic dependence. And that is, I mean, I think the core is sort of the second part of the paper that we presented at the EU finance ministers meeting is really to say, look, I mean, you have to have a proper diversification strategy. I mean, if there are some goods which you source only from one country and these goods are actually important for your value chain, then that makes you vulnerable, right? I mean, that makes you vulnerable to economic coercion. So you need to develop an active strategy of diversification. That doesn't mean reshoring, right? I mean, so many political scientists think, okay, let's just produce everything here. Well, of course, that's not possible. It would be extremely costly to do that. The reshoring option is the most expensive option, according to all estimates I saw. But a diversification option is an option that can work and that will require facing some tough questions. And I do think that sometimes economists dodge the issue that China dominates markets, not just because China has a big market, but also because China subsidizes and protects its market. And of course, when you have that, you cannot just say, okay, two firms, let's diversify, because firms will source where the product is cheapest, and that's where the subsidies are biggest, and that's basically from China. So just telling firms to diversify is not going to be enough. So there is the question of how do you use subsidies, how do you use preferential trade agreements with third countries to engineer somewhat that diversification without completely throwing out with the bathwater the benefits of the multilateral order. I mean, that's the real big challenge.
Yeah, I guess diversification is a public good that is provided in the form of, you know, providing the robustness to geopolitical events, but the private incentives for providing those are really not there. So it's going to be a very tricky thing to convince firms in terms of, you know, factoring these elements into their decisions. So what are the tools we have to do that, or what could be potential tools to use in the future?
Well, I mean, so I think the two big tools are essentially subsidies and trade agreements and somewhat managed trade on certain goods to force that diversification. And you know, the problem, and that we also discuss in this piece, the problem with the subsidy point is, of course, that subsidies are very, very expensive. I mean, the two chip factories in East Germany cost the German taxpayer 15 billion euros. So it's very expensive. Firms are extremely skilled with basically getting the rents without delivering. And so there is a lot of wasted subsidies out there. And actually also quite limited transparency on how the subsidies are used. So I personally, just to say the one word on these chip factories, I mean, I get the basic point that some chip production is too excessively concentrated in Taiwan and therefore creates geopolitical risks. But I also think that I don't have enough information to really know whether the 15 billion actually reduced that risk, right? I mean, there are some factories, but will they really, as promised in the newspapers, deliver the kind of chips we need, the top-end chips and all of that? I mean, we don't know, and the contracts are not public. These are non-disclosed contracts, but the fact of the matter is we spent 15 billion on it. But in principle, the subsidy road is a road of incentivizing firms to do that kind of diversification and providing that public goods. So I think it's really a matter at the end of the day of getting it right. So I think that would be my main point on the subsidies. You want to do that where there's excessive dependency. You want to do it as limited as possible to avoid rent seeking. You want to do it in a way that doesn't destroy your single market, which is also important, right? So you don't want one country to do all the subsidies at the expense of all the rest. And you want to do it in a way that is upholding as much as possible the remainder of the global order, because of course the countries in the global south do look at what the United States is doing with its Inflation Reduction Act, with quite a lot of resentment also. And so you want to keep them on board, right? So these are very difficult trade-offs.
Right. And for the case of these chip factories, you could actually argue that having diversified them away from Taiwan could also increase geopolitical risk, because the side effects for the West of a potential bad event are less stark than they would otherwise be. Now, let's come to the last point. So do you think actually that contingency planning at the EU level in terms of preparing for certain adverse scenarios, so that we have plans ready in case, in certain parts of the world things turn bad, is an important component of geopolitical strategy? Could we sort of ex ante agree on certain kind of plans that would be implemented that we have ready in the drawer, take them out? Is that an important part to get ex ante agreement? Or is this something that is sort of illusionary, only when we see the abyss we are going to come together and going to be able to do something, but ex ante we can't really have a meaningful conversation on this at the European level?
No, I do think we can have meaningful conversations on this. And I actually do think that there are also tools that help us. So, for example, a simple tool such as a stress test is something that has been done in the context of G7 countries. So let me just give you this one example. I mean, the G7 countries have done a stress test of a hybrid attack on the financial system. And sort of what they do then is basically simulate it and ensure that protocols are there, right? Ensure that everybody knows whom to call at what time and has the phone number ready. I had a little paper to an ECOFIN where I talked about a hybrid attack in the financial system on the European Union. And, what becomes there very clear is, again, the old theme that the hybrid attacks or cyber attack combined with a social media attack against the national finance minister, combined with perhaps a heart attack on a deep sea cable connecting a city, perhaps in a northern country, would very quickly have significant effects on one or two or several banks in that country because of bank runs and so on and so forth. And the protocol basically there's not a very strong EU protocol. I mean, there's national protocols and the bank knows the national security authority and whom to call. And it has to probably report to the single supervisory mechanism about the fact that there was a cyber attack against it or a social media attack against it. But then for the security information to trickle on and to go to Paris and to Berlin and to Madrid so that people understand the kind of sort of hybrid attack that has happened and the risks for their own systems, that protocol is not very well developed. So I personally do think there's very practical things like that where sort of contingency planning, stress testing is very important and where everybody benefits if we do it in a more sort of targeted way.
Okay, let me try to summarize all of what you have said, which never is an easy task. So how did we get there? Well, everything looked fine. There were no real concerns, a bit of wishful thinking, but clearly also some underestimation of how China would grow, develop, and as well, say, Putin's determination of restoring some part of the Russian Empire. All that led to the kind of situation where we find ourselves in, where we have to get our act together. What are the main components of a strategy? Well, you said that, well, the EU treaties kind of by nature are very inward looking, and therefore we're not prepared for the world we live in when it comes to that institutional framework, and there is no common foreign policy just as a consequence of that, but that is clearly what you think should be developed, though obviously different countries have maybe different interests, but again, as you said, we probably are learning quickly that there is a common European interest, and if we put our forces together, then obviously we're a lot more effective, and you cited a case with Lithuania and China as one example that made people rethink all of that. The military component, and again, we rely on NATO too much. We need to unify and coordinate our military capabilities, not least because it could be easily the case that the US commitment towards NATO could weaken, depending on how the election next year plays out. Nuclear deterrence, you freely admit that's a difficult question where you would need to think a bit more about before giving an answer. How can we align private economic interests and the public interest whenever there are externalities, like, say, the geopolitical side of things? You cannot rely on private actors, i.e. companies, to make the right decisions. So that needs to be shifted to the government level, and EU coordination is needed here. And again, you think, though difficult at this point, the challenges which are obvious to everyone make it easier. The relationship with China, you said we need a strong conversation here. And we need to reduce our economic dependency. Diversification is important here. Subsidies may be needed, so you sounded cautious about how to do it, or that you really need to be careful when and how much and where. And trade agreements might be another interesting tool or helpful tool to reduce the dependency on China here, though at the same time, you did not argue for decoupling at all costs, rather. I guess that's a strong conversation part. Be careful where you are dependent. Then the contingency level planning on the EU level, it's possible, you said, and there are tools such as stress test that show that it's actually been done, but there also is clearly room for improvement. Was that a fair summary of what you said?
It was a great summary. Wonderful. Thank you.
Well, we thank you for your time today. That was very interesting. And if ever possible, we would like to re-invite you at some future point, because I think there's lots to discuss as well in future.
Yes, with pleasure. Thank you for having me again, Dirk and Adam.